entire urban southern region focused on the facts about the South. Everything had been judged in terms of sentimental.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But here was the, here were the facts. You know, how many children had hookworm in
right.
the county? How
right.
many books were in the library? How many lynchings did take?
Right. Right.
So that and that book read me. I was an editorial writer on the Advertiser, and in 19
when that book came out.
Yeah. I was, I just gone
36, I believe it was.
Yeah, I had just gone from the University of Alabama and became an editorial writer on that time with the grand title of associate editor.
First job you had out of J school?
Yeah.
Was as associate editor of the Montgomery Advertiser?
Yeah, yeah, well, I spent 3 months as a reporter at $10 a week.
Gosh.
And I had been making $175 a month as editor of the student newspaper.
Golly.
I'm down to $10. I was in love with my wife.
Yeah.
My wife to be. But,
you met her at the university?
Yeah, we met in the class.
Were you from this county?
No, I lived here 2 years. My daddy got rolled. He was a railroad conductor, and we had to go back to Montgomery. I was mainly from Montgomery.
What do you mean rolled?
And on the railroad, every 3 months, if I've got more seniority than you have and I want your job, I just put into your job, you've got to do something else.
Wow.
So it was a sad day when we had to go back. But
was Montgomery the home?
Montgomery
where,
was
where you, your
yeah.
daddy was from and where you
no,
grew
he
up?
Was from Scottsboro. He was from Scottsboro. But in any event, that was a... Then this book, reading that book, led me to apply for a scholarship or fellowship to go to the University of North Carolina to do magic work. I got a Rosenwald Fund.
Is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, that that blew my mind, that opportunity.
Went over there and studied under Odom and
right.
Vance and
right.
Guy Johnson and
yeah,
all those
yeah.
guys.
I had a reunion with Guy Johnson 3 years ago. And he was teaching a class on the Negro and American literature and the Negro and American history. And one of the papers was, paper or something, was, what do you think, this is in 1936-37, what do you think race relations will be like in 50 years from now? And I said, well, I wrote this paper, and it was dramatized by the fact that the captain of the University of Mississippi football team, black, married the homecoming queen, white.
You wrote this in a term paper for that class in 36?
The guy said, look, Bill, that's an interesting paper. He gave me an A+ on it. But he said, I wouldn't leave it laying around.
That's wonderful.
But, anyhow, it was, you know, it was a mind-blowing experience
yeah.
to be there with those great
yeah.
people and Frank Graham and
right.
Whatnot. So then I went back I was editorial writer on the Birmingham Post.
Did you stay over there how long, Chaplain?
I stayed a full year, 12 months.
Get a master's?
No.
Just
I was just interested in learning.
Yeah, well,
and
that's
in,
better.
In journalism, you know, at that time, it didn't matter. I've always regretted it. But here's one other thing that you might be able to latch on to. I did collect a lot of material on the Ku Klux Klan of the 20s, a whole lot of material. I was going to do a thesis on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I developed this theme that it was the South's, and this is right in line with what you're talking
mm-hmm.
about, the South's great good fortune was that it had the Klan in the 20s. If the Klan had been delayed until the Depression, it would have been devastating.
Mm-hmm.
But this Klan, it was like a vaccination, antibodies.
Hmm.
The experience with the Klan constituted a vaccination against that kind of deal.
Yeah.
And the...
Well, certainly in the 30s, practically all the newspapers and all the responsible people spoke out against the Klan.
Right, because they knew what it was,
you see.
And... Crack Hannah, who later became the head of the Alabama National Guard, was a strong-arm man for TCI in Birmingham, keeping black-white deal. And the Klan was so in such bad odor in the 30s that he called his organization the Knights of the Purple something.
Something other than clean.
Yeah, because it was such a bad odor.
And, yeah. Where were you born, Boo?
In 13. I'm 77, yeah.
So in the 20s, well, you got out of college in about 31 or?
I got out in 1934.
And you were looking back at the Klan from the time when you were a young boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my daddy had been a violent anti-Klansman. His life had been threatened. He, you know, on the railroad, most men were on the Klan. But I was doing, you know, research on all the Klan in Indiana,
right,
and everything I could find. But I had known about the Klan in Alabama, and I had known that Bibb Graves, who was one of our best governors, and Hugo Black were actually elected in this Klan sweep of 1926.
Yeah.
So I had seen a lot of it personally. And when we would be going to my aunt's, my father's sister, I can hear my stepmother now, he lived in Tallahassee, and saying, "Now, Jim, please don't bring up the Klan, because my uncle was a cyclops of the Klan, but he was also an automobile dealer."
Uh-huh. So that was his brother-in-law.
Yeah.
Your father's brother-in-law.
Yeah. And so that, you know, it's...
And they'd argue about it, I guess.
Well, yeah, they had, and then the Klan had tried to unseat the mayor of Montgomery at one time. The Klan, with the help of a guy named Bob Jones, who's in your state. No, it's where? Bob Jones University.
In South Carolina.
In South Carolina, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Bob Jones.
He was helping him out then.
Yeah. So, but in any event, those were, of course, dreadful times. And they, my concern was hookworm, farm tenancy, poverty, ignorance,
right,
disease, you know, and prejudice.
Yeah.
I had a relatively free hand both times I was on the advertising. Then I went back to that.
Grover Hall was the...
Yeah, he was, he was
the father or the son?
The father.
Was still there.
Right.
When did he die?
Well, he died in about 1939, I went back to the advertisers, added to the editorial page.
In 36? 40.
Yeah, around 40.
Mm-hmm.
And then... When I got out of the Army, I wanted something more dramatic, more forceful. Although I'd had great freedom on that time,
mm-hmm.
And I had written...
By then, was Grover Senior?
Junior
was...
He was a columnist.
He was writing a column, but he wasn't the editor. But
no,
then.
Not at that point.
Uh-huh.
And so I went in the Army, and I met Aubrey Williams, who had been one of the great New Dealers.
Right.
And, he asked me what I wanted to do, and that's why after I got out of the Army, and I said, I want to go back to Montgomery and get a hold of this old farm paper. And he later came back to me.
So then farmer.
He later came back to me and said, would you be interested in a partnership arrangement? I think I can get the money. Well, it was sort of a mistake, but it was an easy out. I was in the Army and whatnot. A friend was... approached a friend who could have raised the money, a fellow named Chris Clements. But that was an easy deal, and I admired Aubrey. So the two of us were equal partners. He was the publisher, I was the editor. And Marshall Field and Danny P. Aubrey, he put up the money.
Put the money up.
But I don't know if you ever saw a copy of it, but...
No, I never did, and I've looked for it in the library and can't find it.
Yeah.
Most libraries don't have
this, we were attacked. One of our main goals was attacking the Talmadges and the Bilbos.
Right.
And I had there was a guy named Glick, and I would go to him and tell him what the what I wanted to do, and he would draw these cartoons, which
uh-huh.
were really, you can see that's
yeah,
a quality
cartoon.
Right. And we were sustained by mail order advertising, which meant we were completely free. And one day we an agent sent us an ad from the Sun Oil Company, fertilizer. And we ran this ad, a full-page ad, and that was great. We'd only had one other full-page ad, and that
mm-hmm.
was from Hattacall.
I don't
know if you remember.
Right, I remember Hattacall, yeah.
So that was great,
Yeah.
It had a fertilizer ad from the Sun Oil Company. And within 2 or 3 days after it came out, this
advertise. They didn't call and said, for God's sake, I've got to cancel that contract. I'm about to lose this account. Miss Pugh found out about us advertising in that paper.
And y'all were considered left-wingers.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that drove him off.
Yeah. And, of course, Aubrey had been well identified. And Aubrey was no part of a communist, but he was in the whole milieu of peace,
and
fighting prejudice and so forth, and anybody, you know, that had that identity.
Was branded a communist.
Right.
And your opinion, though, is that he never was a communist.
Oh, no, he wasn't. And there's a book about him that came out.
I've seen it, but I haven't read it.
Salomon.
Is it a good book?
Well, it... I guess it is. I haven't read much of it. Every now and then, when I get a book, somebody, you know, like that, I'm naturally an ego.
Look to see.
And he didn't have my role was not there. He said Aubrey, or no, he said that Field selected me as the editor. Well,
that wasn't true at all.
I selected Aubrey as a publisher, and Aubrey selected Field as the financing.
Yeah.
But through the circumstances, I left the Southern Farmer. And,
did you leave on friendly terms with Aubrey?
Well, it was that's a 30-minute story in itself. Actually, I was taking an antihistamine drug and went just sort of like a man on champagne, and I ended up in a VA hospital before they discovered what was wrong, and this guy said, just don't take any more pure benzamine, you can go home. But meanwhile, I had disassociated myself with Aubrey, but I liked him and so forth, and whether it was a just deal in the circumstances is not for me to judge, but I don't have any, that's...
You didn't take away any bitter feeling toward him?
No, disappointment, but not bitterness. And so we went to Texas to manage a radio station for a man named Roy Hopkins.
Yeah. This hooks up with somebody else I met, Edgar Ray. You know Edgar Ray?
Oh yeah, Ray. He wrote a book, a tome on
Hoffman.
And he's the only man I know that could make it a dull subject. And of course they got Memphis State to publish it.
Yeah.
You know, it had the, if they had gotten, I guess Hoffman wanted somebody that was going to really do an authorized biography.
Yeah.
But
that's what that was.
Yeah.
Much.
Yeah. And so I was I went out there to manage a radio station for him, and I was his executive assistant when he was mayor. And we went causes there. I was, but this is not about me. But I just will say that we never did stop. I was Barbara Jordan's co-manager of her campaign the first time, two times she ran. She lost those two races for the legislature.
Yeah. But you managed her campaign?
Oh, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I got a letter from her up there somewhere.
Did you go to Texas after you left the Southern Farmer?
Yeah.
In 40, when?
That was 40? About 48.
And when did you come back? To Alabama.
Well, I began coming back about 16, 17 years ago. We would rent houses and so forth.
Okay, I'm going to back off from that then, because my time of interest here ends in 54.
Yeah.
So when you left Montgomery is really where my part of this story ends,
right.
And there's a real crucial question I need to ask you.
Yeah.
You managed Jim Folsom's campaign for governor?
No, I tell you what happened. We don't have the Alabama edition of this paper, but Jim, a fellow named Handy Ellis, who was lieutenant governor, was running for governor. Folsom had run 4 years before, just in a Model T Ford, just went up and down.
Let me get the year right. Would it have been?
Let's see, 46. He was elected in 46.
Elected in 46.
But he had run in 42.
Okay.
So, I had been, I would ghostwrite speeches for almost anybody. And a plumber had come in and said, I got the buddy, I'm going on the air, and I'm going to tell him about Big Jim, but I'm afraid I'll start cussing, and I just been to the seventh grade. And he said, I need you writing this piece.
And you'd do it.
So I did. And
this is why you were editorial page editor?
No, I had gone to the Southern Farmer.
Oh, that's right, sure.
I was Southern Farmer.
From 42, I guess, or
no,
four.
From 46. 46.
Started
I was in
40.
The Army. I was in
that's
the Army
right, sure.
Year. Yeah.
Okay, 46 you
yeah,
were here.
Right.
Stayed 2 years.
Right. And so we had been getting these ads from Handy Alice and Joe Cool, and there were about three or four guys in it. And so I had a, this, after this, the first primary, oh, I called Carmen and I said, we've got these ads. Here's my wife.
Well, how do you do, Miss Grace?
I'm
John Edgerton.
Yes, this
how are you?
Yeah.
Pleased
yes,
to meet you.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'll do some tea. I called up Kerman and I said, I want to speak to the campaign manager. And they said, well, he doesn't have a campaign manager. But he said, my name is Roy Spinney and I sort of run the office here. And I said, well, we've been getting these full-page ads from these other candidates where Alabama edition, we had 60,000 circulation in Alabama and a million in the South.
Right.
And so he, I said, we want to run him an ad. Will you send me a map? I don't know if you know what
right,
that is.
Yeah, sure. But you, when you're doing a little letterpress.
Yeah. He said, what is a map?
He didn't even know.
I said, well, never mind that. I said, have you got some mimeographic material that we could put in an ad? He said, listen, anything you write would be better than what we'd have. Just go on like what you want.
Great heavens.
This is frozen.
Some
so,
campaign.
So I ran this full-page ad and wrote up this full-page ad. Then immediately after the first primary, this state was hysterical. He was a guy that was supposed to run fourth or fifth, and he ran first.
Yeah. This was in the spring of 46?
Yeah, in the Democratic.
Then in April or May primary?
Right, right. And so this guy, don't leave. He said, this plumber came in the day after this deal, when the state was just, there was a guy, you know, just it surprised the whole state.
Yeah.
Because he had the folk behind him. And so this plumber came and said, come go with me. He said, come on, come on. Where are we going? He said, I'm not sure you come on. So we went up, and here was Folsom bodyguard. Ex-Army Sergeant, you could see the old man standing at his door, and we were immediately ushered in, and here's Folsom stretched out on the bed in Army shoes, you know, no socks.
Big guy then.
Oh, yes,
over the
end of the bed, you know. And he didn't get up, he just said, hi, Groove. He said, how you doing? I said, all right. I had never seen him.
Treats you just like you were an old friend.
Yeah. He says, when I got into this, I wanted you to be my publicity man, but I didn't have but six little old weeklies, and I didn't see any need for any publicity man. But I want you to come with me now. And I said, what do you mean, come with me? He said, well, let's go everywhere I go. I said, Jim, I got this job. We're getting this paper underway over here and so forth. And I don't know about that. I said, do you know anything about the populace? He said, well, hell yeah, man. My granddaddy on one side was a populace, and my granddaddy on the other side was a bourbon Democrat. And that's what this is all about. I said, I'll see if I can arrange to go with
him. Oh, mercy.
So I traveled with him, and I...
You were his PR man.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And I was ghostwriting. What I would
do...
Did
you take a leave from the... From the paper?
Yeah, I'd go back and forth, and, you know, but I would just, we'd travel all over the state with him. And what I would do, he had been making these talks.
Thank you so much.
He had been making these talks out at Crossroads where he would just talk endlessly, you know. My job was to compress it if he had, and he hadn't had his radio time until he ran first, and you can imagine the money started coming in,
yeah.
And he could go on the radio.
Right.
So if it was 5 minutes, I would, of 15 or whatnot, I would write, and I had been studying what is the man's name that wrote The Art of Plain Talk? The scale is named after him.
Not the How to Win Friends and Influence People guy.
No. This was a guy, The Art of Plain Talk, this was an Austrian who'd come over here and learn how to write simple English. Rudolf Flesch,
yeah.
And I had been studying that, and this paper checked out at 6 years of education.
At that time, it
was the lowest level reading in the United States, and nobody had, that was our goal, to talk to farmers in a way they could understand. So, dealing with Folsom, I had come academically to a position that he had come to naturally.
Yeah.
He was a door-to-door instrument singer. Well, you know there are two books on Folsom.
Yeah.
My role in that is fairly well defined. So.
Yeah.
When I read this, when I read this for the first time in a long time, the staff gave me this when I left. And I had a regret about the thing because it didn't last long after I left. I don't say that was the reason. There were other things.
Well, but I think the record would be pretty clear, wouldn't it, that Aubrey Williams had so many other irons in the fire that he wasn't running this newspaper.
Well, he had been very helpful. We boosted this circulation up to 1 million with contests.
Yeah.
On WCKY Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd send in the most words you could make out of Southern Farm or whatnot. But see here, I was under Uncle Dudley. I wrote the fiction under a different name. Mm-hmm. I wrote the advice to the Lair of Lauren. Because you couldn't get anybody. I was Joe Cook, the extra money editor. I was about eight different people. We had a staff of eight people.
But they were all you.
All me, yeah. And you just can't hire people to write at a sixth grade level.
Do you have to write the ads too?
No, mm-hmm. I didn't do it. I had very little to do with the ads.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you ever heard of Carol Kilpatrick.
No.
He was a Washington correspondent for the Washington Post. He died. And his name was Kilpatrick. And I just...
Oh, Carol Kilpatrick. Yeah,
he,
I remember that name.
He died about 3 or 4 years ago.
We and you just, this is just a takeoff.
Right. I just use names like that. But, and then I could... I was a cartoonist, but I couldn't draw.
What about the editorial position of this paper?
Well, we were against the more cotton in bed sheets, less for the cake.
Yeah, right. That's a great headline. More cotton in bed sheets, less for the KKK.
You
took an editorial position in here.
We were hell out of hell bent for the small farmer, for co-ops. And even for
black farmers. Your position was...
We were against... See here, I was Nan Roberts, vice of the so that we were against any form of the demagogue.
Yeah.
And... It ran through. Every issue had something about that.
Was that the first issue, number one? Yeah, it said.
Well, that was no. This was volume 107. That was number one.
Oh, but I mean, from the time
I joined it in January.
And did Aubrey also, or had?
No, he had gotten about a fourth. We came down and arranged to bar by it while I was on leave, and he had had it
for about a year.
Yeah. Look at that, first size, first need, a 65% minimum wage.
Yeah.
So,
that's amazing.
It's sort of sad because, see, this paper, with all those mail order advertising, we weren't beholden to anybody.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of.
Well, Mr. Beach, what in the world happened? Let me just sketch a scenario for you here, and then I'll get you to react to it. And never mind the 30s. I mean, we can talk about the 30s, but you know what that history is. I'm talking about 1945, 6, 7, and 8.
Right.
You had Hugo Black, a liberal, had gone from the U.S. Senate to the Supreme Court.
Right.
You had Lister Hill in the Senate, a very progressive man.
Right.
You had John Sparkman there.
Right.
He was a progressive
right.
man. You had Jim Folsom as governor. I mean, this is the Democratic machinery of Alabama, progressive, forward-looking, essentially liberal. And yet, by 1948, the conservatives of the Democratic Party in Alabama were so powerful that they kept the Democratic Party off the ticket in Alabama. You couldn't even vote for Harry Truman in 48.
Well,
what happened there?
Wallace.
George Wallace, that early?
Yeah.
Tell me what happened there.
Well, let's see, and Folsom was elected in 46, and then he could only serve one term at that time. Then John Patterson, I believe,
came in.
Yeah, I left in the middle.
You left in the middle.
Why not?
Right.
Yeah. Now, there's a book, Dixiecrats and Democrats.
Okay.
Bill Bernard at the University of Alabama.
Bill Bernard?
Bernard, yeah. And Dixiecrats and Democrats, and that is a documented, detailed account. And Bill has apologized because again, my role was not quite clear that I was in Texas and he didn't, he said I should have gotten a hold of you, but that's neither here nor there, my role. The important thing is that there you can learn all about that in a documented, detailed
book. Okay.
That's
all
the
right.
title of the book.
Dixiecrats and
Democrats. Right. Bill Bernard.
Is he at the University of Alabama now?
Yeah, he's the head of the history department.
Okay.
Yeah.
But in that period of time, if you look from the 30s on, you have this history of newspaper opposition to the Klan. You have a lot of newspapers in the 30s and 40s with essentially a liberal to progressive editorial policy. They're against lynching, they're against poll tax, they're for fair employment until, you know,
they stumbled on the race issue. They stumbled.
What happened there? Why did they lose their nerve?
They just said. Nobody. Let's see, how old are you?
I'm 55.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how bad it was in Nashville, but I'll tell you how bad it was in Alabama. During the bus boycott in Montgomery, there was a group of women, and later became the United Church Women, I think, but they went out to St. Jude, a Catholic center for blacks, and had a district meeting to pray in the middle of the bus boycott. A scoundrel who had a weekly paper went out and took the license plate down, published it in his paper. One of those men, a husband of one of those women, wrote an apologetic ad in the Montgomery Advertiser and said he was not responsible and his wife was naive and whatnot, going to a prayer, an interracial prayer meeting.
Mm-hmm.
He had to disassociate himself for his wife going to a prayer meeting.
Right.
The intensity of feeling in the lower tier states, I don't know how it was in Tennessee.
It was that way, essentially.
It just, you know, anybody that raised a voice, I had a classmate who was a librarian in the library in Montgomery. She wrote a letter and said, essentially, that this is during the bus boycott, that we shouldn't be disturbed. These are peaceful people. They are following the Gandhi principle. Well, she was relieved of a job, put on leave, and the poor girl committed suicide. The pressures were so great.
Mercy.
Julia Morgan was her name. So that until, you know, this far removed, people can't realize how intense the feeling was. Now,
mm-hmm.
once we got to Texas, it was much more relaxed. Far more relaxed. But in this lower tier. And, of course, the conservatives and business interests were latching on to this issue.
Uh-huh.
They didn't give a damn.
And so what Jim Folsom could say and mean in 1946 or 7 or 8 couldn't be said by a public figure by 1950 or 51 or 2, could it?
Right. And Jim Folsom was put in a squeeze, and he buckled at one point. Lister Hill and John Sparkman had to trim their sails. And it's amazing that they kept afloat,
yeah.
You know, because of their economic position.
Yeah.
And they didn't demagogue on the issue, but they buckled.
Uh-huh.
It was that race hysteria just swept the state.
I hope I'll be back before you do.
Oh, thank you, ma'am.
No, you won't.
We'll be gone, I'm sure. Okay. It's nice to meet you, though. Thank you so much.
They buckled, and that race, it was a hysterical. In 1941, Frank Dixon was the governor, and Frank Dixon gave the appearance of being a modern man. He had lost a leg in the in an aviator in World War I, and he gave the impression of being sophisticated, intellectual, and so forth. And he had many attractive policies, but the reporters kept coming in and saying, God, he said, you can't imagine the story that Dixon was telling today, all off the record. A troop train goes through Montevallo, and black soldiers waving out the window. Montevallo is a girl, it was Vera Carlin.
Mm-hmm.
Said, hey, how'd you like a kid, honey? Horrible, you know. He was just telling all these
racist stories. Was he making it up?
Well, he would just pick them up. I don't know if people mm-hmm. were bringing them to him. And I wrote an editorial, the only editorial that the publisher of the paper, R.F. Hudson, saw before it went into print. I never discussed anything with him. But this editorial, since it was an attack, an all-out attack on Frank Dixon, I felt he was entitled to read it in advance. And his son happened to be back on leave. They both read it. Dick suggested a few sentences to him. But essentially, and R.F. Hudson said, well, if you need to say it, say it. But he said, I guess license plate number one won't be parked at my house anymore.
Hmm.
And so that whole race business was just, as it had been in the 1900s, you know, at the turn of the century, you know.
Yeah.
It was just used and misused and mm-hmm. used and used and used.
Would you agree with my thesis that period was a golden opportunity that we could have seized on, but we weren't able to?
God, yeah.
That's a sound thesis?
Oh, yeah. No.
I think about Bibb Graves, for example. You remember that Southern Conference for Human Welfare meeting in Birmingham in 1938?
Yeah.
Were you there?
Yeah.
Bibb Graves was an active member, and right in the middle of that, his wife was taking women, visiting women around on tours of the city.
Yeah.
I mean, the bank heads were all involved in that.
Yeah.
And by the time that thing was over and that whole fracas about where people were going to sit,
yeah,
everybody, all the politicians took off for a look.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that thing, imagine the enormity of it, of not being able to sit in a room.
Yeah.
They,
were you in that auditorium that Sunday night when Frank Porter Graham made that speech, the opening night?
Right.
That must have been kind of electrifying.
Oh, it was.
You know, 1,500 people.
I've always said that if I've ever known a saint, a man that approached sainthood, it'd be Frank Graham.
That's the truth. I share that feeling. The more I read about that man, the more... I mean, he got everything thrown at him. Communism, you know, nigger lover, all that stuff. And he'd write these people back the most reasonable letters. And he'd say, now, ma'am, I know your daddy, and I remember your uncle so-and-so went to school down here, and I don't think they'd appreciate you talking that way. You can't prove all that stuff.
Well, this, when I was at, this was, they had Daily Tar here was absolutely uninhibited, the student newspaper.
Did it take a pretty liberal point of view?
Yeah. And they had a guy who was actually a a young communist, I'm sure, writing a column.
Uh-huh.
So the establishment leaders, including Jonathan Daniels, came for a visit with Dr. Graham, Texel Head, Department Head, Lorna Head, and they said, "Dr. Graham, we've come here because this is really, this university's got problem, big problem." He said, "This Daily Tar Heel is going to lose this millions of dollars to this university. And it's, we just came here to tell you something got to be done about it." Dr. Graham, you know, he was only about 5 feet, 3 inches tall, or 4 inches tall. He said, "Well, it is a problem." He said, "It's a real problem." He said, "You know, I could do a lot better job of choosing the editor than the students do." He said, "But Joe, your daughter's up here. She has more influence on who's going to be editor than I do, because they elect the editor." And he said, "They got all these classes on civics and election of this and election of that." He said, If I got around here and dabbled in student politics, you can be damn sure they wouldn't do what Frank Graham wanted them to do."
Mm-hmm.
"So I can't do that." He said, "Now the other thing is, I guess that the Board of Trustees would authorize me to read over everything before it came out." But he said, "You know, the state paying me $25,000 a year, and I don't believe it would sit well if I had to take a half a day every week."
Golly.
He said, and then these students, they learn and immature, and they said a lot of things that go in there is just really immature. He said, "It's immature." But he said, they've got these classes over there, and they're studying the First Amendment, and how can you tell them? But when he got through, they just filed out.
Yeah.
You know, they just filed out, shaking hands.
He was stalwart. Shaking hands.
Just that mild-mannered,
yeah,
reason. Just put reason on the table. You know, yeah, reasoning well.
I don't know if this happened when you were there or not, but he had an English professor, I can't remember his name now, who was a socialist, and the socialists and the communists were running a ticket in 1934 or 36, maybe it's 36, I guess. They were running a presidential ticket that had a black guy who was the vice presidential candidate.
Yeah, yeah.
And he came to give a speech in Durham at a black hotel, and this English professor went over there and had dinner with him.
Uh-huh.
And Jonathan Daniels, whose reputation as a liberal is not altogether deserved, wrote Frank Graham a letter and just gave him unshirted hell and said, I'm just gonna, you know, I'm gonna force your hand on this. You got this communist over there and you gotta get rid of him." And Frank Graham wrote him back one of those letters of sweet reason and said, "Hell no. I'm not gonna do it. I'm not gonna get rid of the man."
Yeah.
That's just how he was.
Oh yeah.
He was amazing.
The scoundrels that beat him and that beat Claude Pepper.
Yeah.
You see, that was that whole kind.
That was the, that was the.
It also inhibited those that didn't get beat. See, it limited everybody.
That's and where it ended, right there in that election.
Claude Pepper gets knocked off by that jackass Smallers.
Yeah.
Any guy with courage, you know, with ideas, is liberal. He said, "I got to survive here."
That's where it pretty much ended, I think, with that election.
Claude Pepper
and Frank Graham in 1950, when they lost, a silence kind of came across the South, and it took the Montgomery bus boycott and the Supreme Court decisions to ever change, and even that took 25 years of bloodshed and turmoil, that we could have avoided, I think.
Oh yeah. But the people. There were two kinds of people on that race issue. Those who were sincere, if you can be sincere and be a racist, and those who were exploiting.
Yeah.
And that combination was absolutely devastating.
Well, in Alabama, who were some of those people who were powerful enough to take the Alabama Democratic Party into the Dixiecrats in 1948 and shut down the election and
all
that? Who were
they? A guy named Sam Englegard was one of them. And I believe he was a state senator. I'm a little hazy about some of this, but it's in the Folsom book.
Yeah.
And he actually wanted to abolish his county rather than have it run by blacks.
Golly.
They were, and Jim Simpson, and in Birmingham, represented, he was a corporate lawyer that was trying to defeat Lister Hill. And
did they have Klan ties?
Well,
White Citizens Council
well,
and all that?
They, what they had, you know, they could use a guy like that. He didn't have to, you didn't have to have a Herman Maddox, you know. You could have a guy who would use some buzzwords and
yeah.
so forth. And, and he could get that automatically.
He'd get the people
yeah,
to do his
time,
work for him.
You didn't have to be an outright demagogue,
mm-hmm.
you know, to like Smathers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it, you just,
yeah.
you just, and like, who defeated Frank Graham? I've forgotten.
A guy named Smith, I think.
Yeah.
I well, forget his name,
yeah.
but.
Well, you know, you can say, that kind of thinking doesn't represent the true South, meaning
yeah.
he's not right on the race.
Yeah. Yet.
So they were the whole structure was permeated with that kind of thinking.
Does it leave you thinking, as you look back on it now, that what did happen was pretty much inevitable, that it's probably unrealistic to think we ever could have reasoned our way through to some kind of social breakthrough?
If you had put all the social forces into a computer and you know that the reservoir of racism, and then you were trying to and then you had a certain reservoir of enlightenment, and you had a reservoir of thinking concern as represented by Odom, of thinking about these things logically. To that degree, it would have been inevitable, you know, that reservoir of racism had to be tapped.
Mm-hmm.
It was there ready to be tapped.
Yeah.
And the pattern was so universal.
So it was bound to overflow, in other words.
Mississippi, Louisiana.
South Carolina,
South Carolina. And, you know, there were other things in Texas, in the Texas thing, which is a new sort of thing, but there was some overtone of it.
And so your feeling is it was bound to overflow one way or the other.
Right. It was just a reservoir of racism. And also, you see, that had been built up with the Klan ideas. That had been built up, and it was reinforced by the people who provided the money for all kind of publications and all kind of political campaigns.
Right.
And there was the one period there in populism. Of course, that was another watershed.
Mm-hmm.
But the Democrats. The Bourbon Democrats used the race to destroy that.
Right.
So that this was a
when the first this wasn't the first opportunity we had that we,
right,
we blew
right,
away.
Right.
It happened before.
Right. That was a populace with 3,000 cooperatives. Imagine.
Yeah.
I was in North Carolina. I was at Chapel Hill. Mary and I were walking on riding along a country road, and I stopped this old fella, and there was a big old almost castle-like structure up on a hill. And I stopped and I said, what was that? He said, that was a cooperative shoe factory.
Golly. Back in the 1890s.
Right,
in
the 1890s.
Wow.
And, you know, they had, they were fighting the jute trust and trying to wrap their cotton in, bale the cotton in cotton. And so that Tom Watson, they had one man that represents enlightenment and absolutely destructive racism in the course of one man's life.
Yeah.
Books, I don't know whether history affects books, influences books, or books influence history, but if I would say that there were two authors, I guess W.J. Cash maybe would be in there, but Howard Odom and Van Woodward.
Yeah.
Those two people really influenced history, I think, for the better.
By helping people finally to understand what direction to take and,
right.
and by searching in the past, you figure out where to go in the future.
Right. And I know in my own right, Van Wood was Tom Watson Agrarian Rebel. Tom Watson Agrarian Rebel. But that was so vivid,
mm-hmm.
and you could see so clearly what was happening after you read that book.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a lot of his works helped to clarify right. history and put it on a more factual basis.
Uh-huh. The churches and the universities, two other big institutional pillars in society, also had been more liberal, it seems to me, in the 30s and early 40s than they were when this got to be a red-hot issue.
Right. Have you ever read Will Campbell?
Yeah.
Oh, boy, that is some book. Isn't
you
it?
Like that book?
I think
Brother to a Dragonfly?
Yeah, yeah, I think that's
a great book.
Yeah.
It really is.
A sensational book.
Yeah.
And speaking of books, have you read or seen The Clothes Had No Emperor?
No.
Goodbye.
No.
Slansky?
No.
I'm going to see if I've got
it. I don't know that one. That Folsom was a combination of genius, moron, and alcoholic.
I love that.
Sometimes he was a pure genius, and sometimes he could be very dense. And then some days he was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And it was so tragic.
You never knew which day you were going.
He didn't, that man didn't realize 20% of his potential.
Yeah.
And of course, we didn't know, back in those days, we didn't know about alcoholism.
Yeah.
You know, we just thought it was sinful or stupid or whatever.
Yeah. Did you have the feeling, after that golden opportunity passed and the Wallace era began and the South was in turmoil and all that, did it give you a sense of regret that that somehow the South hadn't been able to capitalize on full...
Yeah.